Welcome to Founder Chats, the show where I, Josh Pigford, founder of Baremetrics, hop on a call with my founder pals and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with my buddy Walter Chen from I Done This and Animals. Walter grew up a reluctant math whiz and became a lawyer primarily because he didn't know what else he wanted to do. Soon after actually becoming a lawyer, he realized that wasn't his jam and quit to go on and found multiple startups. Walter's an amazing content marketer, and we learn how he used that to grow I Done This and ultimately to start Animals, his content marketing agency. Hope you enjoy. All right. Thanks for joining me, Walter.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Josh.
So let's, I guess to kick things off, I'd love to kind of get your backstory. Like what were you like sort of as a kid?
So as a kid, well, I think the sort of one of the big formative things is that my dad is a math professor. So growing up, I did a lot of math, and I was like, I had to do math all the time. My dad made me do a lot of math. So that was both good and bad for me, because obviously I was a huge nerd, and I grew up in a relatively small town in Texas. So, I got picked on a lot. But on the flip side, I learned math, which was good for the future.
Did you enjoy it, or was it like a chore?
It was very much a chore. I hated it. It was like every summer, my dad would, his kids go out and play. Like, I had to stay in and do math problems, and then I would go over the math problems at night with my dad. And that was before I learned that the answers were in the back of the book, so then I figured that part out. But
So like, instead of your parents like telling you to go outside, they tell you to do math.
Yeah, exactly. So like, whenever we went on vacation, we had to bring math books and we would do math problems, take a couple hours of the day to do math. So yeah, my dad, but the thing about my dad is he really loved math. And for him, it was a way to, he grew up really poor in Taiwan, and he was the way he got out of that was by being the best student. But he really learned to love math, and he doesn't want to retire, he just wants to, die doing math. But he never instilled that in me. And for me, it was just you have to do math all the time, and I hated it. So it was something that was I was always trying to get out of.
So did you feel like you were good at it? Even was it even this source of okay, I don't love it, but I can do it.
Yeah. I was pretty good at it. I got pretty good. I had some pride about it, but on the other hand too, it kind of made me fearful, because everyone expected me to be even better. You know what I mean? Everyone was like, oh, yeah, Walter's a math prodigy, blah, blah, blah. And then that made me really scared, because I knew I wasn't a math prodigy. I was just pretty decent at math and made to do math all the time. These people thought that I was just really good at math. It just turned out I just did a lot more of it than they did.
If anybody sat there and did 20 hours of math,
exactly. Get good at it. So actually, that was part of growing up. I was actually it made me really fearful, and I was always afraid of looking stupid or getting stuff wrong. And so then that was the kind of thing where I didn't want to show people that I was trying, Oh, you hear this all the time. But so that was something that I had to later fix, which was not worrying, not being afraid, trying to do my best, asking questions, being not afraid to look stupid, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So you did. So math was a chore. I mean, was that the case with all of school, or did you enjoy some parts of school or other subjects?
Yeah, I don't know. I would say that I mostly didn't like school, and my whole life, one of the things I've been trying to figure out is what do I like? Because most things I don't really get that much enjoyment out of. So school I didn't really like. I liked playing soccer, playing basketball, going outside, running around, that kind of thing.
Was there ever any sort of entrepreneurial bone that you got to flex as a kid, or did that come later?
When I was a kid, I had some garage sales and lemonade stand, that kind of thing. Nothing big. My dad tried to encourage me. Actually, he went to Denmark once, and he saw these really cool things. They're just little tchotchkes or whatever, that things, discs that you spin, and they make lights and stuff. And he was like, oh, you could sell these door to door. And I was like, all right, sounds good. So I tried it and I sucked at it. And so nothing happened there. He was imagining dollar signs, but nothing happened.
Sure. So for your dad, I mean, like, you know, math and I guess education was his way out of Taiwan.
Yeah, right?
So do you feel like he viewed education as the end all be all, or just more like the relying on yourself to make stuff happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, to me, like, you know, and you hear this a lot, like, to be an immigrant, to like give up everything and come to the United States, like that's like the ultimate entrepreneurial spirit. And like, I have so much respect for what my parents did, and I admire them a lot. And you know, my dad is like a really curious person. And so, yeah, so I think it's kind of more that bit. At the same time, like, there was a lot of emphasis put on education, and also, you know, also within like Chinese culture, like respect for elders and stuff like that. So it's right. kind of like a weird hodgepodge. Like, I would say that, you know, it doesn't fit the mold of like the, like what you typically think of as entrepreneurship. But I think of my parents as very entrepreneurial and instilling a spirit of just like trying to be your best and you know, achieve the highest that you can achieve and that kind of thing.
So after high school, went to college, and you went to law school?
Yep.
So how does somebody who's like not, you know, super into school, but I mean, end up at law school?
Yeah, actually, that's a funny way to put it. It's a really good question. So growing up, like, in addition to like math, like, you know, obviously I, like a lot of kids, I screwed around with computers and stuff like that, mostly just liking to play video games. So I played like a lot of StarCraft. I had no idea what I wanted to study in college. But I just remember that I like got a kick out of computers, and I thought like computer science might be cool. So I did that. But when I got to college, like I went to Cornell, which like engineering is kind of known for being a little more hardcore. And also I kind of had that thing too, where I liked to like, I thought it was cool to like stay up all night and stuff like that. You know what I mean? And so I was doing that, like pulling all nighters or whatever, like in the computer lab for a week straight, you know, awake from like 4 PM to 4 AM. And then I was like, I got super burned out like of that. And I thought like, I was like, one, I never want to pull another all nighter ever again. And I never did until I started practicing law. and then I was also like, I'm sick of computers. I'm sick of like hanging around with dudes all the time. Like I hang out, you know, sick of like, you know, all that stuff, right? Math, all that stuff. So I was like, all right, I'll try to do something different. Still like laws, like still applying kind of like a lot of, you know, like logical thinking, blah, 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 but like in a different context. Yep. So yeah, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. That was the main thing. I had some job offers to do software, like to be a programmer, but I was like, it doesn't seem that exciting. So,
I mean, it seems like for somebody who doesn't, when you don't know what you want to do, you picked like some of the hardest things you could possibly do.
Well, that's actually funny because my dad always told me, my dad's thing is always like, it's like, if you don't know, like, if you're going to, like, go to college, if you don't know what you do, like, do something hard. Because if you do something hard like math, if you wanted to do physics later, you could do that. And if you wanted to do computer science later, you could do that. Stuff like that. Of course, I didn't want to do physics or computer, you know, I didn't want to do any of those things. But but it seemed reasonable to me. It seemed like a good point. Like, trying things that are hard, there's some value in that. Like, I think I learned a lot from that.
So you finish law school, and then what, you go on to actually practice law?
Yeah. So I went to Michigan for law school, and then I worked for a judge in Detroit for a year. That was a formative experience for me. And it made me think that I might actually enjoy being a lawyer. So then I took a job at a relatively large corporate law firm practicing law in New York City. And I did that for
you were doing actual corporate law?
Yeah, I mean, and this is like a bunch of blah, you know, jargon, but it was like litigation. So it was on the litigation side, but it was like, you know, for large commercial interests.
What aspects of that, I guess, were appealing to you? I mean, you mentioned like, not to say that it's not appealing to people. I mean, I'm curious, like, obviously every kind of job or field kind of has parts that aren't great or like you don't enjoy, but I'm curious, like, what parts about being a lawyer did you, you know, actually enjoy?
Yeah, and kind of get that's a really good question. In that, like, yeah, it's like people assume being a lawyer like totally sucks. Actually, it can be really interesting and intellectually stimulating. And I think it's actually more intellectually stimulating than being an entrepreneur. In that, like,
I mean, there's a ton of complexity.
Yeah.
You just kind of have to sort through.
Exactly. Like things are very complicated. There's a lot to learn. You're expected to like learn really fast and learn lots of areas of law that you don't know very quickly. And you need to master it very quickly. So that's interesting. There's stuff at stake, right? Because there is a dispute of some kind, right? So there are interests at stake. People care about what happens. So that's cool, right? And then you go home and you read about what you're doing in the paper, and that's cool. Like, for example, I worked on the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, and this was in 2009, right? So it's like it's cool to feel like you're at the center of the financial universe. and stuff like that. So I think that part is cool. I think, reading and writing, if you like to read and write, like, it can be really cool. I think the part that makes it drudgery that a lot of people complain about is, in like large scale commercial litigation, there's a lot of documents, right? So one, there's a lot of documents. So people spend their time doing what's called doc review, which is, you know, going through thousands of documents. Like I did that, like, where, you know, I went like through like 5,000 documents in like 3 days or whatever, you know, and you it's like pretty mind numbing. The other is that, there's a lot of process, and sometimes it just feels like it's all process and all kind of like making each other miserable and complaining, you know? So, yeah. Yep. So that was, probably more than you wanted to hear on that.
No, that's great. So that's what, 2009, 2010.
Yeah, 2009, 2010. Yep.
And so then, I guess, where is this after this was when you made the transition to I done this, or
yeah?
I mean, like,
yep. So
how did that
I quit start? My job in September 2010. To take us,
and what was the impetus for quitting?
Yeah. So there were a few things. One, I got mono in that year, and. And while I was at home for 6 weeks or whatever with mono, I was like, you know, here I am with mono, first of all, at 26 years old or whatever. That's not cool. And then I was also like, what do I want to do with my life, right? Am I enjoying what I'm doing? All that stuff. So it was around that time that I decided, like, okay, when I get better from mono, I'm gonna finish out the last few months to make it a year, and then I'm gonna do something else. And around that time, too, a good friend of mine who became my co-founder with I Done This, he was doing a physics PhD and he was not enjoying it either. So we were kicking around a lot of ideas on what we might want to do. We had actually been introduced because when I was in law school and before when I was in college, I had been interested in like starting a company and doing a I had always been interested in technology. Yeah. And so we had always been kicking around ideas. So it just kind of came, it kind of started bubbling up.
Gotcha. And what was, I mean, how did the idea itself, like the product part, come about?
Yeah. So Rodrigo, it was my co-founder, his name. So in September, he quit his PhD, I quit my job, and we both moved to San Francisco. And we had this idea that we were going to do, we had kicked around a million ideas, some of which were interesting, and in retrospect, some companies have done stuff with them. Of course, we would have had no idea what to do with it. But anyway, we were like, okay, we're going to do apartment rental applications online. This is a common idea you see because, like, it's a problem for people like us, which are, like, dudes who are renting. And so we were like, oh, yeah, you should do this better. It shouldn't be with paper. It should be online, blah, blah, blah. So we built this thing. And we tried to talk to customers and stuff like that. But obviously it was like pretty far outside of our wheelhouse, like talk to landlords and stuff. If we were to do it now, we would do it a lot better. Back then we were like, you know, really green and also like kind of afraid and fearful and stuff like that. So we built that. Nobody cared. We got like one person using it. And then we had this third co-founder, and he actually owned property in Chicago. So we ended up selling just like the code to him. And So that we that happened from like September 2010 to like December 2010. So in December 2010, we had like hit a low point because we had like got we were like so excited. We're like we're building an amazing startup, and then in December we're like this sucks. Right. Like we just sold the you know what I mean? Like,
it's hard.
Yeah, exactly. We're like in 3 months we're like oh yeah like now nobody's using this, and I guess we'll sell the code to like this friend of ours for you know for you know like sort of pennies on the dollar. Right. And it was during that low point. I was moving back to New York, and it was during that time where my co-founder Rodrigo was like, "Hey, I got this idea. Like, I want something to keep help me keep track of what I get done every day, and I want to use it to like work out and exercise. Do you want to build it with me? We can like launch it for New Year's, January 2011." And I was like, "Yeah, let's do it." And it was like the last thing I did, and then before I moved back to New York, so we built it like not expecting anything. We launched it, and then I left.
Gotcha. So I mean, did you move to San Francisco purely based on the sort of like, that's where the, you know, the tech scene is, or was there some,
yeah, it was like, it was that, and, it was like where Rodrigo wanted to live. And I always liked San Francisco. Like I lived there one summer before when I was in law school, and I always thought it was cool. So yeah, it was a combination of all that.
Gotcha. And then moving back to New York City, was that just, you know, if you enjoyed San Francisco, what was the reason to move back?
Yeah,
to New York
so
City?
my girlfriend was in New York, and I just really liked New York better, and that's why I live here now. Yeah, that was so brought me back.
So I Done This comes out what, January 2011? I mean, did you guys launch it in January?
Yep.
So, I mean, what happened after you launched it? Obviously the apartment thing, you know, was sort of fell on deaf ears, didn't really go anywhere. What was the reception like?
Yeah, it was like people liked it. That was the weird thing. So, I mean, by today's standards, obviously it was not an impressive launch, but we put it on Hacker News and it was on the front page near the top, you know, and then the Next Web wrote about us, after the first day was over, like we had like 200 users or something like that, 200 people signed up, and we were like, "Oh my god, this is the greatest thing ever!" right. So yeah, that was kind of what happened.
Were you guys? I mean, you know, you say you have 200 signups at this point. Can anybody even pay you?
No,
for it?
No, it was like just a personal product, just for free, just to like keep track of what you got done every day.
So, I mean, a to-do list, essentially.
Yeah, to-do, except the reverse. It was like what you got done rather than what you were setting out to do.
Right. So what's the next steps to transition this from like a free sort of consumer-based thing to something people could pay for and would pay
for? Yeah, that's a great question. So just kind of fast forward, yeah, like we didn't even work on it for a few months. April, we picked it up in April because it got picked up by Lifehacker, and that's when we went from like hundreds to thousands of users. And then we were like, you know, what should we do with this? And, so we applied around to some, you know, startup accelerators or whatever. We ended up getting into AngelPad, which is, based in SF. And the thing about AngelPad that they were really excited about was that, they were all from Google, and at Google, they had done something called Google Snippets, where they would send an email out to everyone in the company on a weekly basis, asking what they did last week and what they plan to do in the following week. So they were like, "Oh, this is really cool, and like this could be something like Google Snippets," which they all found really useful. And so we moved to SF in June. I moved back to SF in June. Fun fact: our first office was, we shared an office with Postmates when they were just three founders, and so we got to see them take off. Wow. And then we did AngelPad, and so it was around that time, like we had this momentum where we were like had tens of thousands of free users by that point, and then we were able to it was like sort of like a freemium thing. We were able to convert them into paid users, the ones that you know, like signed up with the work email address and that kind of thing. We converted a fair number of paid users, and we basically built like I Done This for Teams, which was basically the same as I Done This, except like when you write what you got done every day, it got shared with everybody, and then in an email digest that like came through the next day. So it was like a kind of like a progressive transition, and then at that point, like we basically had two products that were like very similar product wise, but very different customer wise. Like there was a free people who were using it kind of like for a journal, and then there were the paid customers who are using it within their companies as like a Google Snippets kind of thing.
Did you guys, I mean, was there basic like sort of feature parity between the two, or did you treat them as two very separate products?
We were really stupid, I would say, in that like we didn't have a coherent strategy for it. Like we were like, we just wanted to see the numbers go up. That was like one of the big problems. We were like, okay, we're focused on our paid users. We want to make more money, but we also want to sign up more free users because it's cool to get those numbers going up. They shared like a similar code base, but they had like different, it was pretty hacked together. Like they shared similar code. And so they had similar features where you could give a feature for free, you know, it would kind of apply across both, but like there was a lot of, it wasn't well organized. And so, yeah, some stuff was for both, some stuff wasn't, et cetera.
So from a marketing standpoint, like the thing that sticks out to me the most, I mean, when I think of like, I've done this is from a marketing standpoint is the content side of things. So what role did that play in the grand scheme of things as far as growing?
Yeah, it was huge. I mean, obviously Baremetrics does a really great job with content. So thanks for saying that. So it was huge. So basically it started because I used to be a lawyer, right? And I was like, I like to read and write. And also a major influence was that Buffer was in our AngelPad class. They were in the same class with us. So that was huge because we saw what Buffer was doing. And not only that, Leo, who was the main guy behind it, like he was really generous and he would sit down with us, explain what he was doing with content, like explain why, how it was working, blah, 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 like what he was thinking, what his angles were. And Buffer was like a huge supporter and amazing friend of the company. So basically it started like, okay, let's write some blog posts for the company blog see what happens. And we did, and it like we early on a lot of we had a lot of initial early success with that. So like we had huge uptake, and then like these blog posts got like tens of thousands of views, and like it drove huge spikes in signups. And seeing that success early on is what made us like keep doing it.
And so at that point, I mean, you know, I think one of the things we have the hardest time with Baremetrics and producing content is like the stuff that does really well is stuff that I've written not because I'm like amazing or anything, but like because the stuff that I'm able to write purely based on the fact that it's like from one founder to another works really well. So I mean, were you producing the large majority of the content, or were you like outsourcing some of that stuff?
Yeah, I early on I did all of it, and then we hired Janet, who is a friend of mine from college, and she had just graduated law school and wasn't sure what she wanted to do. So funny enough, she had just graduated law school. She didn't know what she wanted to do, so I was like, hey, why don't you, like, I know you're a great writer, why don't you write content for our blog? And she joined, and then she joined full-time, and now she runs marketing at Customer.io. She's doing amazing. And then after she left, we hired Blake, who was a journalist from Michigan, and he did a great job. And then when we sold I Done This, he joined Status Page, did an amazing job for them, runs content there now, and is there now, and was there through the acquisition. So I did a lot of content early on. We had great luck like hiring great content people.
What did you guys do, any other kind of marketing, or was it 100%
I mean, it was nearly 100% content marketing. We did some other stuff, some of which was actually successful, but we didn't double down on it. So the only thing we really doubled down on was content. So for example, we did this whole like outbound thing. This was before a lot of people were doing it. We built our own system for like sending personalized emails to companies we thought like would be good customers. So like, for example, we had a thesis, like, you know, companies that have just raised a seed round, like they're scaling their team. So they're like they're becoming more anxious that they don't know what's going on the team on a day-to-day basis. Like, let's send them an email telling them about I Done This. So we would like pull from like, you know, AngelList and like TechCrunch and stuff. And then we would create email lists and then we'd email them. Actually, it really worked. It worked really well. It wouldn't work well today because it's just so much saturation on that front, but it worked really well back then. Yep. It's just that we didn't like, anytime anyone sent us email was that was like angry, it made us depressed, you know? And then like, and also it's just like, it wasn't that fun. Not that that's a good reason. And now I realize that is very not necessarily a good reason. And then another thing we tried was Google Ads, but we did a really bad job of it. And actually at one point I like accidentally spent like $5,000 without knowing it. And then when that happened, after that happened, I was like, no more. I'm not good at this. And I was trying to do it on top of a lot of the other things that we were doing. And so it wasn't, given the lack of focus and the lack of knowing what I was doing, wasn't really a good idea.
So something I always noticed about you specifically is that, I don't know if you still are, but certainly during the I Done This days, you were a prolific guest writer. I mean, so many, I just kept like, you know, whatever it is, like Inc. and what others have I seen? Business Insider. Yeah. And I mean, just ton, like, tell me about that. Like, how did that stuff come about? And what role did that sort of play in ultimately getting more or growing?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one common one problem we had, and a lot of companies have this problem, which is basically we saw initial success with our content, and it was because distribution happened on Hacker News and it gave us a huge bump. But distribution via Hacker News is not a repeatable strategy, right? Especially now. It's like back then it actually was much easier to get on the front page whenever you wanted to. Now it's very difficult. So we needed to diversify our distribution and build our own distribution. You know what I mean? So you actually go from this place where it's like this is the common like startup grab. It's like, you know, huge spike early on, you're feeling great, and then you go through the trough of misery, whatever. And so like part of going through that is building your own distribution. So one of the ways we did that is like through guest posting. So for example, Business Insider, like we actually just through reaching out, we built a syndication relationship where they actually read, they set up a feed on their end of I Done This post and then just syndicated the ones that they liked. So that's a great example of like, enlarging your distribution in a way where you don't have to do any extra work. So like we built a relationship with the Business Insider team. They agreed to like syndicate nearly all of our blog posts to Business Insider. Great for us. Amazing for us, right?
Yep.
Similarly, like just building relationships with other content people, like anytime you wanted a guest post, reaching out, and this is about like doing something that's valuable for both sides and also giving value to them too. So like obviously other folks guest posted on I Done This and we help promote other companies. It just came out of that problem of like, how do you build your own distribution and make it really reliable and repeatable?
So, I mean, in that sort of same vein, I mean, I think one question that a lot of people who produce any amount of content have is, how do you balance doing something like say self-hosting all of your stuff? Like, you know, you've got say the company blog or whatever versus, you know, lots of guest posting versus say using Medium as the place to put all that content. Like how do you view content in the grand scheme of things? You know, there's like the SEO side of things, but there's also lots of other reasons you would post content. So, I mean, like for you, what's the, maybe like a high level strategy that you think works really well?
Yeah. Let me think. Yeah, you know, I think at the end of the day, like, content is about creating value for other people and, like, helping them be successful in what they're trying to do with or without your product. It's about helping your audience, like, succeed, right? And so my general take on that is, like, it's really important to like, build value on your own property. So like owned channels, like, you know, your own email list is, you need to build traffic to your own blog, that kind of thing. The thing is though, that what a lot of people do is like, they'll save all the good stuff for their blog. And then when they do a guest post on another site, it'll be like awful. You know what I mean? And it's like, or it'll be like the same. And so I think that the easiest thing to do is just to take content. It's basically, this is the win-win. It's like, I have content on my blog that I know is successful. I'm going to give you I know it's successful because I look at the metrics and it's one of the most successful blog posts. based on that, I will do another version of that content that will, that I know is going to, because I know it's going to be successful, it's going to help you too. I'm going to post it on your blog and it's going to be helpful for you. And to someone who, like, to someone who's running a blog, like, they're like, okay, that's great. It's not a duplicate and it's not trash, sure, right? It's like, if there's some reason why it's going to be good. And, you know, we have like, you know, and like, so it's about giving value to everybody. Like, for example, like early on, Kevin Lee, who now runs the Buffer blog, like he was like, Leo introduced us. Again, Leo, great guy. He introduced us and was like, Kevin's one of the best up and coming content guys. Like, you should talk to him. So he did a guest post on our blog about, I forgot it. It was one of those like science behind, like, you know, that kind of thing. And it was great for him because it got, you know, it got, it gave him a chance to like, you know, write on another blog, get more exposure, that kind of thing. And for us, like, it actually was a huge article. Like it gets thousands of views a month today. And over the course of, since it was posted in 2012, it's probably gotten nearly 100,000 views. Like a lot of people don't like, you know, a lot of people like guest posts kind of have a bad rep because most of them suck. But like, when someone gives you real value on your blog, like that's amazing. And then it also benefits them. So it's about creating that win-win.
Gotcha. So, ultimately you decided you sold, I done this. So that happened in what, 2015?
Yep, November 2015.
So how did that come about?
So, the short is that Elizabeth Yin, who runs 500 Startups, introduced me to Jonathan Siegel, who is a guy who basically runs private equity for SaaS startups, and he's bought a lot of them, like Follow Up CC and Cloud App and stuff like that. So she introduced us, we talked, and then we kept in touch over the course of like a year and a half. And by the end of 2015, like Rodrigo and I were pretty burned out. So then, yeah, we sold the company.
What do you feel like contributed to the burnout?
Well, a few things. One, Rodrigo and I are friends, and actually we just had dinner last night. But if we were to work together again, we would probably do it better. But we have pretty contrasting work styles, and we always kind of were at odds. But we always stuck together because we're friends, we like each other, that kind of thing, you know? And so neither of us was willing to give up, but it wasn't a super great relationship either. And the other thing was probably, it's just typical. It's like the ups and downs of startups. Like we were going to sell at the beginning of 2015, but then we had this huge growth thing where we launched a new feature and like, we got 4 months of really great growth.
You get a bit of an adrenaline rush.
Yeah, 4 to 6 months of really great growth, and then it went flat, and then kind of some of the great growth we got as a result of that feature kind of reversed itself. So we were like, but it wasn't the first time that it happened. It was like the 10th time that it happened. So that was like, we've had enough of this.
Sure. So, I mean, for you, what was the big takeaway from building I Done This? Like, what, all said and done, like, what was your big takeaway from that?
Yeah, experience? I suck. Like, I still haven't digested it really well. If I were to just say three takeaways, one, I would say, founder market fit. So, like, this product, like, we created, is what I said earlier, it was kind of inspired by Google Snippets. Neither of us worked at Google. Like, neither of us, you know what I mean? Neither of us had, like, worked actually as a professional developer or in a real professional environment. Like, Rodrigo had came from a physics PhD, and I came from, like, working at a law firm, which was very different from, like, the way most of these companies operate. So we didn't understand our customer, and we didn't understand the product, really. Half the time, we were just wondering why people even liked it. So that was, like, that was a big one. And the initial idea was, like, as this kind of, like, personal product. So that was a big one. The other one was like, and this was something like that, like I listened to Heaton and Stelly's podcast, the Startup Chat, which is great. Yep. And they were talking about like, don't treat your startup as a baby, like your baby. And I think getting overly attached is a problem that I have. So like not being able to make rational decisions about the company, because I was always like either depressed about it or, you know, or like,
you're like attaching like your own self-worth to.
Yeah, exactly. Product. And I still have this problem. It's just like getting, not being able to think clearly because you're like depressed all the time or whatever. Not truly depressed. So I don't want to, you know, sort of make that sound cheap, but like you're always kind of like sad about it and stuff like that. Or like manically working on it or whatever. And then I would say that the last one was kind of, the last one is related to market. It's like, productivity got, really competitive and the standards got a lot higher. Like people, like, in productivity, people were expecting like a, even in B2B, like productivity tools, they were expecting like a consumer like level of polish on the product. But we didn't have that at all. Both Rodrigo and I were not good, strong on the design side, and we never hired a designer, which was a mistake. But like we, like it got really competitive. Like one of our customers was this great, this company called Taco, which was founded by, I forgot his name. He's a very important guy. He was formerly like chief software architect at Microsoft. And at the end of like 2012 or something, 2013, he said like the two tools I used the most in 2013 were iDoneThis and Slack. And we were like, oh my God, this is amazing. But like Slack just like just raised the bar so high. And like it made us like... Yeah. Be like, oh my God, like we can't, we vaguely are going to have to compete with Slack. I mean, we can build on their platform, blah, 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 but we're, you know, it's vaguely competitive in that, like it keeps everyone in the loop. Right. And you know, and it like makes superfluous, like a lot of tools. And there's no way we can ever create a product with the level of polish that Slack does. So I would say those three things, basically are kind of three major takeaways.
Gotcha. So you wrap up at iDoneThis, and then you take what, you know, this whole like content machine that you've kind of been building over the past couple of years, and you start what's essentially a content agency.
Yeah, exactly.
Correct. So called Animals. Yep. So, I mean, like did you like exit iDoneThis directly into that or take some time off?
Yeah, I was really stupid and I didn't take any time off. So like... I was like, yeah, I just went straight into it. And I actually felt the effects of that. Not immediately, obviously, because you're super high on starting a new thing. But like, sure. Like, you know, 8 months later, I was like, oh my God, like kill me. I did not kill myself. And, you know, and so, yeah, but I would have liked to take a vacation. So yeah, that would have been a good idea.
So I mean, give me like the quick summary of what you guys do.
We try to help B2B SaaS companies, like create the like very best, highest quality content.
So what's for you the biggest difference between running a software company and then running like a content?
It's just like one word. It's just like people, you know, it's like, people as far as the eye can see. How do you, manage people? I think I would have, if I had done this company and then I'd done in basically in reverse order, I think it would have made me a lot stronger entrepreneur. And that's why I think in part why you see a lot of people who've run agencies, like then like start product companies and be successful with it is because like you have to know a lot, you have to learn a lot about like cash flow and also managing individuals, like managing people, which is like probably one of my biggest weaknesses.
I feel like most entrepreneurs would benefit not from like a business degree, but from a psychology degree.
Yeah.
I mean, like if you're going to go to college or something, for that, you know, so I like, is it harder for you? You know, you talk about cash flow there. So with software, you've got relatively stable, income, but with, when you're doing like this sort of project, like billing companies for work, like it can be a lot more volatile.
I mean, so one idea which both helped and hurt us that I had coming into this was like, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to run this company kind of like a SaaS company. So all of our contracts or whatever are recurring. So there is like recurring revenue, which makes the business a lot more predictable. at the same time, like, but the main difference is that you don't have software margins. So you have to like make sure that you have margin and make sure that you're making money. Some people think it's really easy to make money as an agency, but sometimes it's actually tricky to understand whether you're making money or not. So our model is like we'll bill on a recurring basis for a certain amount of work, not a certain number of hours. And so sometimes we're ahead on work and sometimes we're slightly behind on work. And so if we're behind, like, and people have already paid us, then it's like, you know, it's like you have to reconcile that. You have to like make sure that you're actually making money. With the amount of overhead and like different expenses and how much people cost, you know, it's like taking your individual salary and multiplying it by like 1.5, you know, something like that. It's like insane, right? So like making all that work while still delivering a lot of value to the customer, like that's you know, that's what you have to figure out.
So are you guys sort of taking the role of, I don't know if you, I mean, is ghostwriting, would that be the right term? Or are you guys like, do you take like a byline on an article?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah. We write under other, we don't call it ghostwriting because I feel like ghostwriting is vaguely kind of like, yeah, it's not that flattering of a word. Right. We write under whoever wants the article under, you know, it's like we'll write under whoever's name. We don't necessarily take a byline. And a lot of times too, it's like, it's their idea. It's their, you know, they're the ones that like bring a lot of value to it. So yeah, we'll write under whatever helps the company the best. That's what we'll do.
And how are you guys growing? I mean, like getting new clients,
it's all word of mouth referral. Like our website used to be like, you know, had nothing on it. And so it had this kind of like, I don't know, you know, like speakeasy kind of vibe. Like people had heard about us, but there's no way to find out more about us. So yeah, right now we're just going entirely through word of mouth. A lot of our customers, like, have been really great about, you know, telling people about it. There is a need for content, obviously. So yeah, a lot of people have been talking about us and that's how we've grown the business.
How do you guys compete with, content can be kind of a commodity if like quality is not the name of the game. So how do you compete with people who maybe don't understand the value of like, of really high quality content?
Yeah, so we try to work with really great companies that are committed to content and like want great content. And our whole thing is about doing great content. So it's just like we don't really pay attention to companies that don't care about that. And we just focus on the ones that do.
Gotcha. So you've kind of gotten out, you're out of the software game, and now you're growing the agency side of things. So what does the next year look like for you guys?
Yeah, so we actually have built some software. We built like a way to manage all of our internal workflow, which we spent like, I don't even remember $15,000 on or something. I don't know, something stupid. And then we decided to scrap it all when we started using Airtable, which I think is basically the most amazing tool on the face of this earth. So we started using Airtable. We scratched all of the software we had built. But now actually we're building software on top of Airtable. so it might be the same mistake. It's possible that it's the same mistake, but it looks a little different this time. So we'll see. Next year, I mean, we're trying to scale the business basically and do more high quality content. And the challenges are just like one, logistics, like keeping every track of everything. So that's like where software really helps, where process really helps. And then the other is just hiring and training people and retaining people. Which is also, that's like the major people side. So that's the huge challenge there.
With software, and this is coming from somebody, I mean, me, who is a product guy more than anything. And so for me, it's like, I have this certain amount of excitement about, like, I know that we've got some big new thing coming with Baremetrics. So that kind of keeps me really interested in like, how are we going to present this and launch this and, you know, will customers, how do we make it really valuable to customers? But with an agency thing, it's less like, what's this cool thing that we're doing next? And it's, you know, if you're wanting to actually grow the business, it's about scaling the thing that you're doing. So for you. Is that a positive thing? Like, do you enjoy the scaling of, in this case, people, or like, what is it that makes you really excited about running?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one, I think this is the thing I always ask myself, and I think one of the things that I've kind of felt recently, and or at least reflecting on this question, is like, I do really like helping people succeed. I like to help people internally a lot, a lot of young people. We have a lot of young people, and it's like helping them learn and grow, and take their skills and turn them into something that's valuable. And then on the flip side, like, I get really invested in customers and the people that we work with, and I want to see them succeed. Like, it's really important to me, to help them be successful. And then the third bit is like, every piece of content like we do produce is kind of like its own little product. And so like making sure it's awesome and then seeing people react to it and like seeing people get really excited about it, that makes me feel really great. So that's kind of, those are the main things. And then we do have like kind of like product like things where we're like, okay, we're going to, so like, for example, we're building this app on top of Airtable. That, and a lot of it's like customer facing. It's making it easier for customers to like give feedback on stuff. And like, it makes the logistics easier because it has a cleaner interface to like what the customer's trying to accomplish versus like doing everything over email or whatever, or doing it over phone calls and then losing so much information. A lot of that is just about scaling, but then it's about thinking about like, okay, how do we like organize the relationship that we have with the customer to make it like as productive as possible and like, and help both sides, like make this as seamless and easy as can be.
Yeah. No, I think like one thing that I have found, interesting over the years of with Baremetrics is, in the sort of CEO role, I've found that I enjoy a lot of the sort of, I don't know, business optimization kind of stuff. It's almost sort of this puzzle to figure out that is a lot more interesting than I think I would have imagined.
Yeah. No, definitely. I think, yeah, there are a lot of interesting challenges. I mean, there are a lot of things that, like, I'm not the world's greatest manager. And I think I'm good at dealing with people in normal life. But there are many times where I'm really bad at dealing with people, and like some of them have definitely come out running this business. but I think there's enough to enjoy, at least right now. Yeah, I mean, there's enough to enjoy, to make this like something that I think is like really valuable. And our customers really appreciate what we do, and I think it's, I think that's great.
All right, Walter, that is all that I have got.
Cool.
So. Yeah, thanks for hopping on a call, man. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks for taking the time, dude. It was awesome to chat.
All right, there we go. Walter Chin from I Done This in Animals. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have feedback, I want to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com, or on the Twitter @Spigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to a heaping pile of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes and a share with your friends and family goes a long way. Thanks, and see you next week.